This week, the Dow Jones Industrials Average plunged another 500 points, while gold and silver ended near the break-even point. Hello and happy Labor Day weekend, everybody. Chris Waltzek back with you for another info-packed show. We've got top industry guests to help us all make wiser investment choices. In this week's episode, James Turk, founder of GoldMoney.com, returns with less than sanguine comments on the equities markets. He expects more market turmoil, culminating with a 2008-like credit crisis. Plus, he's convinced that the precious metals sector is nearing a sustainable bottom on the heels of a two-year consolidation, and silver could lead the charge higher. Next up, Peter Granditch rejoins the show with thoughts on geoeconomic events. The plunge protection team is behind all of the market rebounds we've seen following that big rout in the equities markets. His work suggests that a break, though, above 1,200 in gold could lead to 13, even 1,400 in short order. And then Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest economic report. And if you'd like to call in with your questions and comments, we'll be recording a Q&A session in next week's show. Our toll-free hotline, 1-206-6665-370. Again, 1-206-6665-370. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with the market weather recap. Partly cloudy weather appeared over the New York Stock Exchange this week on dollar strength amid renewed rate hike expectations. The yellow metal gained momentum as investors turned to the safe haven amid increased global equities and currency market volatility. Gold shed only $11, ending at $11.34. Silver finished near the break-even point, ending at $14.55 an ounce. The XAU Gold and Silver's equities index, however, dropped 3.5 points, shadowing the U.S. equities markets off 7% at 45, and West Texas Intermediate crude, though, blasted higher by 0.75 points, wrapping up the week with a 1.5% gain around $46 per barrel. Well, news that the U.S. employment rate dropped to a 7-year low increased odds of a Federal Reserve rate hike on September 17th. According to a Labor Department report on Friday, 173,000 new jobs were created, while the jobless rate actually declined to a 7-year low at 5.1%, the best number since April of 2008, in the heart of the credit crisis. In addition, July unemployment was revised higher to 245,000 from 215,000, while the June figure also added 14,000 to the number. Plus, average hourly earnings increased more than anticipated as workers were offered longer schedules, a strong indication of robust economic output. Fed officials continue to hint that the benchmark lending rate will rise for the first time since 2006, given the substantial improvement in the U.S. labor market. And frankly, investors weren't too pleased with what they saw. They're forced to adjust expectations as the easy money starts to work its way out of the market. Precious metals, bottom line. Well, until the Fed dispels or confirms the rate hike concerns, I think many investors will remain on the sidelines. Although it's not a very popular viewpoint, I'm sticking with my 6-month-long rate hike forecast that by September 17th of this month, we will have at least a 0.25-point rate hike at the FOMC meeting. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, heavy clouds returned over the New York Stock Exchange following the 1,000-point sell-off in the Dow 2 weeks ago, and then last week's small rebound. Investors again lightened their equity exposure ahead of the anticipated rate hike. Higher rates make corporate debt less attractive, and it increases interest payments, which lowers corporate earnings and guidance. The Dow Jones Industrials Average was off 0.5%, 540 points, finishing the week at 17,477. The S&P 500 finished at 1988, off 18 points, 1%, while the NASDAQ gave back 144 points, 3%, finishing at 46.83. The top story pushing U.S. equities prices lower stemmed from the August jobs report, which is the only remaining employment figure ahead of the mid-September rate decision. Given the surprise on the downside, traders interpreted the report as a solid indication that the Fed governors will boost rates. Bottom line on Wall Street. Fear continues to ratchet up to excessive levels. Our 7-component fear index and the VIX, though, are really starting to show some serious signs of capitulation. But until that volatility is let out of the markets like air out of a tire, caution is advisable. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with your favorite guests. We'd like for you to stay with us right here at GoldSeek. Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Peter Grandich has published commentary on the mining and metals sector for decades now. He's currently president of Peter Grandich and Company. Welcome back, Peter Grandich.
Good to be back.
Interesting article recently from Bloomberg. We find that the People's Bank of China is supporting the Shanghai and related equities bourses as well as their yuan by means of selling the U.S. Treasury. And we all know they've had just trillions of dollars in their reserves for some time. They've dropped, according to Bloomberg, $315 billion in their foreign exchange reserves just over the last 12 months, and that's from their $3.65 trillion stockpile. So they're talking right now, officials, of dropping somewhere in the neighborhood of $40 billion from that $3.5 trillion stockpile for the remainder of this year, according to the experts at Bloomberg. There's a lot going on there. Firstly, there's a lack of faith in the U.S. Treasury. Secondly, the potential for inflation. And thirdly, a significant manipulation of their markets. Give us an idea of how this might impact listeners' portfolios, please.
We'll start with the fact that I don't think there's doing this to manipulate the market. I believe China's doing it to raise capital to defend its own markets. And since they have such a large position in the treasuries, as we speak, it was reported earlier in the day that they were selling German bonds as well. And that's understandable given what's going on there. Two, I think it's also important for those still don't believe that there's manipulation in U.S. markets, whether financial or gold market, that here's another country outright literally telling the world that they're manipulating their own market. And so anybody that doesn't think the U.S. has been in defending its markets of late, I think is foolish. In fact, I'm convinced just the way the market traded a week ago Monday when we opened 1,100 points down that the only way the futures could come back that fast would be a controlled intervention. Nevertheless, what is happening in China is part of a bigger picture and something that still most American investors refuse to grasp, and I think that's because the don't worry, be happy crowd that works in the financial service industry that services them doesn't speak about it, and that is that for quite some time now, China has been the engine that's been pulling the world economy, not the U.S., and we became more of the caboose, and how critical now the fact of what's happened in China and the ramifications are not going to go away in a day or a week. And I think that's still not being priced at all into U.S. financial assets.
Let's move on to the next topicality. Charles Hughes Smith, a favorite of mine, penned an interesting article about growing suspicions that the Fed might have been behind the recent stock market crash. And, you know, that I scratched my head at first. I said, the Fed behind a stock market crash? Aren't they, you know, one and the same or in bed with the plunge protection team? How does that make any sense? Well, according to another analyst that he's watching, the Fed has spent something like, or the plunge protection team, the PPT, $23 billion over just a three-day period, and they still had a hard time stabilizing the stock market. You know, we saw more weakness today on Monday. Any thoughts on these comments?
Well, yes, like I just said before, I'm convinced, and I don't have any smoking gun, but it's something that if you watch long enough, the way the market had traded on that plunge day, that there was some sort of intervention. And I don't believe it's the first time in a while. I believe there's been a steady intervention over the past few years at certain critical points. It's silly that we now know that most of the Western world governments have either openly admitted or have been shown to be involved in their own markets, and to think that the U.S. somehow doesn't involve itself in its own markets is foolish. So I think it's credible. I understand why you would want to have a plunge protection team. I think it would be silly if they didn't have one, but I also think the fact that if they had to resort to it, there's a lot more difficulties, and it's just not going to dissipate or go away in a day or a week.
One wonders, though, after, I think, holding up these markets for at least 12 months, the PPT, just why they would have let it drop as far as they did. I mean, as you pointed out, you know, Monday of last week, 1,000 points intraday before closing, if memory serves, at 588 at the end of Monday. And that on the heels of last Thursday and Friday's 1,000-point plunge, plus the Dow had been moving sideways for 4 months. Awfully stiff decline, almost reminds one of 1987. I mean, you look at the charts, the hourly and the four-hour charts, vertical decline. With the type of firepower they have, double-barrel howitzers, ahead of this proposed Fed benchmark lending rate increase as soon as 2 weeks from now, upcoming FOMC meeting, especially given some of the comments that we're hearing out of the Jackson Hole, Wyoming meeting of top global economists.
Well, I think, first of all, you really can't compare anymore to 1987, because realistically, there's nothing of how the markets operated back then that still exists. For instance, while you can watch the CNBCs of the world while they're on the New York Stock Exchange floor, you're basically watching a museum. Almost all of serious interest and trading activity trades away from the New York Stock Exchange. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that, unlike in 1987, there are weapons of mass destruction involved. We didn't have people trading on whatever a computer says or what some mathematical rigmarole thing comes in and says. And it's really, when people say it's a casino, it's actually past that. It's a technical thing that I don't even know if truly the regulatory people or the people that even own the exchanges truly understand what could happen. I mean, it's just so much difference now and so many bigger parts of a typical trading day. I think it would be much difficult now for a plunge protection team than it was back in 1987, and that might be the problem. You know, the way ETFs trade and the way certain trading programs come in, and now with off exchanges and guys able to trade in milliseconds. I mean, it has built for a while. And while everything was going well, people felt good. I've compared it to anybody that's had the pleasure or displeasure of playing in a craps game in a casino. There's an odd time when one table gets particularly hot, and no matter how many times the thrower throws it, it looks like there's no seven anymore in those dice, because just numbers after numbers are made. But eventually a seven comes, and then eventually most of the people, if they don't walk away, will give back a good part of what they had. And I just think what's happened in the last week is the preliminary. It's not the main show yet. Not that we're going to have 1,000-point down days as normal, et cetera. But I don't think people realize how different. When I started, I started in 1984. It really was buying part ownership of a business. That's what you did when you went out and you bought a stock. Now the vast majority of people that are active intraday and even on a day-to-day basis may not even know what the name of the company is or care, because it's just, in a sense, it's just a bet. And there's no fundamentals or concerns about they might invent a new product or a new service, and that's why I'm buying or selling. It's just a way of trying to make money, just as if you were passing by a couple people shooting dice on the corner. That's another way of making money. This is more sophisticated, but that's what most of the people have come to.
This is what everybody needs to be thinking about, cogitating, discussing. There needs to be an open forum on this. I'm so glad you brought it up. So let's start off with the idea things are different from 1987. You had specialists. You had, my uncle had a seat on an exchange. He saved up like a lawyer or a barrister to purchase that seat. I think it was $600,000-$700,000 at the time. He ran an office. It was about building businesses, at least to an extent. There's always been the Livermore, Fisks and the Goulds. That will always be there. But for the most part, it was generally about increasing commerce, boosting the economy, and creating jobs, at least at a fundamental level. That's all changed. But now, where I disagree with you just a little bit, and it's not, I don't think, too profound, but I think it's an important note needs to be made here. I mean, I think the powers that be have an incredible ability to manipulate the markets. In fact, I think using the leverage that's available to them, especially through some of these money center investment banks on Wall Street that are supposedly running their operations for them. I won't name names, but everyone knows the top three or four. It doesn't even take, I think, but a few billion dollars to control the better part of the market. And one other little point here, the stock and the bond market are relatively very small compared to the Forex market, the Forex exchange, which has been one of my favorite markets now for going on 5 years. Trade regularly $3 to $5 trillion in the Forex. I mean, you won't get that in a month in the stock exchange. There's a lot more at play here than I think the typical everyday investor thinks about. But one thing that I don't think has changed, and I think this is one of the reasons why the Dow and the S&P and the NASDAQ are a little different from most markets, it's still that 401k money. It still flows in every 2 to 4 weeks, from people's 401ks and their pension funds and things of that nature, especially with, relatively decent unemployment numbers. So people are buying their company stock. They are reinvesting some of those monthly profits into it, and it gets directed through mutual funds and pension funds into that market, okay? And as long as that faith is returning to the market, I'm not convinced that that's so much of a quantitative automated trading casino. Now, once they lose that confidence, and we might be on the cusp of that right now, don't you think that's the watershed moment where people have lost their faith in the markets? Now it really is a craps game. It's roulette now. Okay, I mean, it's really that big of a casino. Any thoughts?
First of all, when I answered you first, I answered regarding the plunge protection team, and there's a difference between a moment, a minute, and an hour's worth of trying to stop a decline versus manipulation that's an ongoing basis. And what I was addressing versus 1987, in 1987, there was no ad valorem traders. There were no off exchanges. There was basically the New York Stock Exchange, and 86% of the trading was still retail. So it didn't take the Fed very hard to go into a futures exchange and have six or seven of its representatives buy stock futures. That is a much bigger challenge for them now when we trade so much in such a short period of time. And that's what I said was the difference. In terms of general manipulation versus, well, no matter what, there's always this extra money so the market can never go down theory, as you present that, 401k money comes in. That works so long as there's net buy-in of the main things that people buy, like mutual funds and exchange-traded funds. But what we saw leading up to this plunge, which was a tip of that we could run into a problem, was outflows. And when you have outflows, despite money coming into the so-called market, it didn't go into the equity funds. It went into money market funds. It went into other type of things that don't get placed into the stock market. And that's really what needs to be understood, too, that even though mutual funds used to be a very dominating force, they're not as dominating anymore because so much of the money is in things that are just so short-term oriented. And that is what's made it much more difficult for any manipulation on a short-term basis to be as effective, because they're playing against people who are not playing the same way that they played the market back in 87. One of the things, and I lived it, that was what initiated my claim to fame. I watched them shut the Chicago Board S&P 500 futures pit on October 20th, even, when after the 500-point decline, when they still couldn't open up half the Dow stocks by 1 o'clock on the 20th, and they left the Kansas City Board of Trade 500 S&P 500 futures trade. Now there, it traded one-tenth the volume. And within 20 minutes, 12 of the most well-known financial institutions decided coincidentally that it was a great time to all go long the S&P 500. It drove up the S&P 500 futures equal to 1,100 Dow points then. That's what allowed all the Dow stocks to open up, and we ended up finishing 170 points up that day. That's how close and what was necessary back then to turn the market from the abyss. The other day, what we saw is, especially to be down 1,100 points within 11 minutes of the market opening, it's just unimaginable. I know people that I know that traded for 40 years that I spoke to and said that they never could see that such a decline could happen so fast. And, you know, they have prepared for that because they literally have now installed where you basically have circuit breakers that if you hit a number, you just stop trading. Because if they didn't, they could these type of mechanical trading things that have no emotion or no set levels could bring it down 3,000 points.
You know, when we start talking about points, I think it's appropriate to qualify that we're not talking about percentages here because, you know, if you think of 1987 from peak to trough, that was at least 25%. And we haven't seen anything quite like that yet. I mean, that would take us down about 4,000 points in order to get in that ballpark. That was certainly a shock to the system. And I think this surprising drop in volatility since then underscores and highlights what the two authors I was referring to earlier were saying, that somebody stepped in here. It might be an invisible hand. There was obviously some intervention going on behind the scenes. They say Deus ex machina. There was something going on that we'll probably find out about 6 months from now. I'd like to move on to the precious metals. You know, obviously investors are returning to these markets amid some of the volatility in the equity sector and offshore. Also, we're seeing a lot of lack of harmony and disunity in South America, finding out about major food riots down there, runaway prices bordering on hyperinflation. I don't like to use that term too loosely. Big currency turmoil. The few folks who were able to procure some gold and silver are doing much better these days than their neighbors who didn't. Do you see a moment like that in the U.S., or will our bond market and related fail-safes absorb the threat of runaway and galloping prices?
I think the most important thing for gold this year was really the announcement by just about everybody across the board that it had died. I mean, not too long ago, maybe 4 to 6 weeks ago, there was literally 10 to 20 articles and news reports of people predicting, you know, its end, it's a relic, it's a 1,000-year bubble busting. I mean, if you had a dollar for every story that ran, you would have a good amount of money in your pocket. I think from a purely contrarian standpoint, in 31 years around all markets, I've never saw a market be so one-sided viewpoint, not just on the regular media stations, but really across. Even the what was left, if there's such a thing left as a permabull, basically had thrown in the towel. And so that was just extraordinary. And despite all of that, it didn't break down. It broke, went lower, but it didn't officially break. And now you got a record amounts of shorts. People had not been short in such a long time. You have basically everything in the kitchen sink that should have taken it down has occurred. You know, how much more can the dollar go up? How much lower can commodity prices fall? You know, My opinion is I think gold rallies on the news that the Fed, if it does, which I still think is up in the air of a hike, it will actually rally because it's all been priced in. And quite frankly, I wrote this morning on my own blog that I think if we get two consecutive closes above 1165, followed by a psychological close above 1200, we could see perhaps one of the biggest short squeeze rallies of all time, and we could be up a couple $100. I mean, we would have to take that pre-action to occur to cause then a following of a couple hundred. But that's how one-sided the market came. So I just think, just from a contrarian standpoint, it's interesting. Then if we start to look at general fundamentals, how anybody could sit here and tell me that fundamentally, just the life of gold's trading and its history of what it serves versus wanting to own a bond at 1% or 2% and say that that is less riskier to lose principal than in gold is absurd in my mind. But, and this is, I think we've had this discussion before, 99% of the people that work in the financial service industry live off the sale of financial assets. So they will never look positive in gold simply because that would be, in a sense, a knock to the thing that they sell and talk about all the time. So that is always the biggest of challenges. But I would say that even pushing myself away from it and not saying I had any special flavor to it, if they took my child and said, look, a year or two from now, what's up more or loses less, the bonds or stocks or gold? I take gold without a question.
I'm kind of torn because I had a guest last week. David Nikoski is really a top-notch technical analyst, and they really, I'm sure, agree with most of your analysis here. I think we all do, listening to your voice today. But at the same time, the problem is, without a solid, you know, head and shoulders, double or triple bottom, you know, we can talk fundamentals all day long till we're blue in the face. But if the technicals don't support it, it means that there's just a lack of confidence. And without that confidence in investors, traders, speculators, hedge funds, pension funds, you name it, you know, throw a professional in there, I don't think it's going to bring the everyday investor back to the market. They like to see that momentum. But I mean, until that mentality shifts or changes, I'd sure love to be bullish here.
That's what I'm saying. There aren't even people that for many times look very favorable at it, even turn negative on it. I understand about technicians, and I think technical analysis is a good form, especially if you're short-term trading, I think, because a lot of things become self-fulfilling prophecies. Two things I don't like about technicians, when I hear technicians like guys say, well, it's an ABC thing, but then when it goes the other way, well, it turned out it was a D wave and not an ABC. Well, the moment I hear a technician then turn and add something fundamental, I toss them out. So for a pure technician, I have a lot of respect for. But for long-term and cyclical type of stuff, I still say that you still need fundamentals. And like I said, you might, by the time you'll see the positive fundamentals that would send in most of the people that would not be in, it'll be several hundred dollars higher. All I'm saying is, despite all the bearishness for a lot of years, never has it been to this acute. And just like you just said, even yourself, someone that has been very favorable for a long time, now sees this inevitable break. And all I'm telling you right now is, it may very well be the case as we speak, but if we get above 1165, we're going to see it in the first wave of significant short covering and get us above 1200. I would have my stops there because I think if it goes through that, you're going to close your eyes and you're going to be looking at 1300, 1400. But we'll see in a few weeks.
Peter, what brought me to these markets other than a passion was in the early 2000s. First, the strength in the sector. You started to see that strong technical strength building in the XAU. You had a really nice, solid head and shoulders. You had tons of time to accumulate. There was no rush whatsoever. Could have spent a year or two accumulating, looking for buying opportunities as that head and shoulders was just building up momentum. And that continued, those positive patterns continued for 12 consecutive years, it's no longer present. And because it's not there, I read the fundamentals all day long. I love nothing more. I read David Morgan last night, folks who I've followed for over 15 years, almost 15 years. But in the final analysis, you know, we can't talk up the markets. I say this with nothing but due respect for your work and everybody listening here. Until that changes, until that framework, that foundation is in place, to me, why spin your wheels on the bull market of the past? Let's wait until this thing really turns around and shows some stability. That being said, I'm all for building a nice solid position in your portfolios. It's a wonderful beta balancer so that you know don't have too much exposure to any one sector like stocks, bonds, real estate, things of that nature. Nothing tops gold and silver. It's still my favorite sector. I just don't want to see any more people who have just focused completely on this one group.
I'm not a gold bull. I don't trade it anymore. I don't have any involvement in the mining stock. All I wanted to point out is that in 31 years, I never saw any possible investment be so totally tossed out, left for dead, and as you and others who might have been once bullish turn neutral or net bearish, what have you. I got a call from a leading journalist who covers the gold market, who's been at it quite some time. He said, the only reason I looked you up, Peter, because I haven't spoken to you in a while, is I've called every person I know that I conceivably thought might say something bullish on gold, and everybody's bearish. And that was when we were at 1030, 1035, when we looked like we were going to break. And I just said to myself, it's finally happened. It's taken a lot longer. You're right. A lot of people got burned thinking they caught the bottom before. But from a pure sentimental standpoint, it finally happened. It totally went bearish. And that's all I can say is that even if we were talking about soybeans or a type of shirt, just seeing that overwhelming move certainly tells me that we're at the turning point. How fast it goes back up and how far it goes may be in question, but I have no fear, my personal self, that there's a substantial loss still to come in the gold market. But like you said, we'll know that in time.
Well, I applaud your initiative and your determination. That's certainly admirable. If I were going to take that side of the coin, I mean, I would certainly point to the ruble and that amazing devaluation that really came out of left field. Gold was in a downtrend in terms of rubles, similar to what we've been experiencing here for 4 or 5 years almost. A blink of an eye, just 7 weeks' time, anybody who held gold in Russia, I think they made over 100% return, maybe 200%, due to the massive decline in their currency, their purchasing power. You know, it was just a decimation. Please try not to use us here at GoldSeek as a contrarian indicator. You can only watch this day after day for so many years without catching a whiff of bearishness. I think that goes with the territory. But we've run on way too long here, which is always fun, talking with Peter Grandich, the head of Peter Grandich and Company. I wonder if you could tell folks more about the neat services that you provide and where they can catch up with your latest commentary, ideas, and get in touch with you if you'd like.
Sure. Peter Grandich, that's G-R-A-N-D-I-C-H, petergrandich.com. They can just give an email there and get our alerts. I do still speak about markets in general, the economy. We also are financial planners both for the general public, and I deal a lot in the professional athlete community. Thank you, sir.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant cave
KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Well, James Turk, founder of GoldMoney.com, author of The Coming Collapse of the Dollar and How to Profit from It, as well as additional tomes. Welcome back, James Turk.
Thanks, Chris. It's great to be with you.
Thank you. Maybe we could start off today with market volatility. I think that's really putting it nicely, and certainly an increase in unexpected moves, and not only in the currencies, equities, China's stock exchange at the Shanghai Index. Really, I think the model for almost 1987 style meltdown. Can you give us an idea, an overview of what you see happening, and maybe any of the fundamental drivers that might be underpinning this volatility?
Yeah, I think the volatility comes because of the level of debt that we're seeing throughout the global economy, you know, at the government level, corporate level, and even at the individual level. There's just too much debt. When you have that debt, the volatility is a consequence. Instead of, you know, relying on savings, money is being created out of thin air in order to perpetuate a system that's become unsustainable. The only reason why the debt crisis hasn't been more severe is simply because interest rates are much lower than what would be a normal rate. You know, interest rates are below the inflation rate instead of above the inflation rate. So if you put money in a bank and you deposit it for a year, the interest income you earn is less than the inflation rate, so you're losing purchasing power. I think as a consequence of what we're seeing now, Chris, in terms of stock markets, you know, gyrating all over the place, that we're probably going into a 2008 type situation. And this is probably going to play itself out over the next several months.
Well, speaking of playing out over the next several weeks to months, September 16th, about 2 weeks from today, we haven't had a rate increase, as I understand it, from approximately 2006, approaching a decade. There's a lot of ambiguity here. On the one hand, I have a number of guests who are adamantly convinced that there will be no rate hike whatsoever. And then on the other hand, there's those who oppose the thought and their thought and think, well, rates are going to move much higher. I'd like your thoughts on whether or not you think we will see a quarter point rate hike in September and perhaps another rate hike in December, whether or not the markets have discounted this as they usually do, and if that will be two and done, and we move on from there.
You know, the Federal Reserve has backed itself into a corner. If rates were going to go up, they should have gone up long ago. You remember Bernanke was telling us that when the unemployment rate dropped below 6.5%, he raised rates. Well, that hurdle was passed long, long time ago, and they never raised rates. The reason why they don't raise rates is because the U.S. government cannot afford to pay a fair rate of interest. This is a point that I've been making for quite some time. So all you're seeing from the Federal Reserve is propaganda. Now, the Federal Reserve credibility has been basically destroyed by not raising rates already. As a consequence, they may try to raise interest rates an eighth or a quarter of a point to try to regain that credibility. But if they do, I think the markets are just going to react negatively to that rate increase because the markets now are not expecting any rate increase this year. So I think it's going to be more of the same, or the Fed's going to try to do more of the same. But as I say, they've boxed themselves in.
I've been on record now for 6 months, convinced just from reading sort of between the lines, the rhetoric stemming from Fed officials, for instance, the Jackson Hole meeting, James Bullard's comments last week, and several of the other Fed heads have just convinced me. And I know there's going to be lots of listeners hearing our voices saying, who cares what the Fed's going to do? They're just along for the ride. But they still have a pretty solid howitzer. We just all need to keep that in mind. All right. We mentioned briefly currency volatility. Clearly, the U.S. dollar, the greenback, has been remarkably strong for a year. Does a year a trend make? Is this a flash in the pan? Or are we looking at a new sustainable theme in the U.S. dollar?
No, I don't think it is sustainable. What's happened is the U.S. dollar has been the the choice simply because it's the least bad alternative. The euro, you know, has its problems, which are quite serious. British pound has problems. Japanese yen has problems. Chinese yuan has problems. You know, so where do you put your liquidity? People have moved into the U.S. dollar. The next big move is going to be when people understand that the U.S. dollar's got problems too, and that liquidity is going to go into the precious metals. And as we look toward the end of the year, I think we're going to see strength in the precious metals. You know, we've been in a basing pattern now for a couple of years, and so far attempts to break out of that base have been turned down. But we have an important divergence that's formed. You know, silver went to a new low in August, and gold did not confirm. Usually that's a signal when you get divergences like that, that the markets are ready to reverse course. So I'm pretty optimistic here looking toward the end of the year that I think we're going to see both precious metals, both gold and silver, move higher. And my expectation would be that silver will lead simply because it's the cheaper of the two precious metals. It's more undervalued than gold. Even though gold is undervalued, silver is even more undervalued.
You know, that's interesting because I don't know that we could really say the beginning of the last bull market in, let's say, 2001, really depends on what your metric is, in the precious metals, the 12-year gold rally. Can we really say that AG led the rally? I mean, from my perspective, what really garnered my attention following the internet bubble, I mean, I was looking around, is there going to be another bull market? And my eyes were fixed on the inverted head and shoulders, triple bottom, and the XAU. It really was the XAU. And I just thought, this is one of the most interesting basing patterns I have seen, and this thing is going to have legs. I would love to see the XAU show some relative strength juxtaposed against the underlying metals. Any thoughts?
Yeah, you know, the XAU is impacted quite a lot by the currency appreciation and the price of gold in different currencies. So, for example, the South African stocks have done generally better than the American stocks or the U.S. stocks because the price of gold has risen in South African rand terms, but has not really gone anywhere in terms of the U.S. dollar. So you're getting these cross currents in the XAU. But my view is that if both gold and silver move higher as we move toward the end of the year, the mining stocks will move higher as well, simply because the mining stocks, again, are extremely undervalued, particularly some of these major producers that are still paying dividends and generating good cash flow, even at these price levels.
Last week, we heard from the second in charge at the Fed, Stanley Fischer, one of the Fed governors, and he certainly, I think, indicated there is some ambiguity among them. They're not all lined up. Not all the officials there, not all of our policymakers are convinced we need a rate hike. And I know we've already touched on this, but the GDP revision, you might recall, 2.3% up to 3.7% from the second quarter. That seems to indicate that economic conditions might be a touch more robust than our officials were anticipating. And in that environment, do you think that we might see a really solid buy opportunity, an unexpected capitulation moment across most markets, particularly equities, commodities, and whatnot?
Yeah, I think that there won't be capitulation in the stock market. But basically what you're, in other words, I think you may continue to go lower if they do start raising rates. But you really have to focus on the dollar here. The Fed's got two alternatives. They either save the dollar or they trash the dollar. If they trash the dollar, the stock market in nominal dollar terms will rise. If they save the dollar, the stock market's going to fall. So we just have to watch very carefully what the Fed's ultimately going to do action-wise and what the impact that's going to have on the U.S. dollar. But remember, when you see these Fed pronouncements, they only tell you what they want you to hear. That may not necessarily be the whole truth. So you've got to look through the announcements, read between the lines, and actually see what the markets themselves are doing and just basically follow those trends. And right now, the trend in the stock market is clearly, you know, it's clearly turned. But we've seen this before back in 2011, and we bounced to new highs, or we, you know, made new highs. So let's just watch and see how it develops over the next couple of weeks.
Who knows exactly how things will play out, because we've watched some interesting, I think, policy changes from Beijing. The People's Bank of China obviously reversed course on its dollar accumulation, or, you know, U.S. Treasury accumulation. accumulation in that $3.6 trillion in U.S. Treasuries, primarily in their national stockpile. Considerable selling going on to approaching maybe even one-third to a half a trillion dollars of U.S. Treasuries. That has to be absorbed by the market. To me, the buyer of last resort is most likely the Federal Reserve.
Yeah, I agree. And if they're the buyer of last resort, that means they're going to trash the dollar. Yeah, you're raising a good point, because when times get tough, each country will act in its own best interests, regardless of what they may say to their neighbors. And what we're seeing here, times are tough in China, and as a consequence, they've been selling U.S. Treasuries, and that's obviously going to have an impact. But so far, it's just been a trickle of selling by the Treasuries. We'll see whether the Chinese stock markets continue to fall and whether or not the Chinese government's going to sell more Treasuries to try to prop up stocks.
Well, I think on that note, we can wrap up today. Please tell people more about the services you provide at Gold Money, and if we can expect any more best-selling tomes?
Yeah, the last book, The Money Bubble, is, I think, still, you know, even though it came out in 2014, is still very timely in terms of what it has to say, because it focuses on these points we've been discussing about the dollar, the money bubble, and what to do next, or what to do before it pops. So that's the latest book. Nothing else in the works, but you can also find my stuff at goldmoney.com, or, you know, we're now part of Gold Money Incorporated, the Toronto listed company, and therefore bitgold.com.
We appreciate your thoughts. We'd like to hear from you again, especially after we finally see what the Federal Reserve does and just how that impacts the markets. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Heading into Labor Day weekend, there are many pieces on the economic chessboard at all levels. Local, state, national, international, and global. The sheer size, number, dynamics, and interrelationships between all of these moving pieces. Debt, derivatives, gold, equities, bonds, cash, geopolitical implications, supply-demand deficits, oil, politics, and the list goes on. And I've only scratched the surface of a few items. It's a constant task to associate, assimilate, integrate, and understand where we are headed at any given moment and why. The market is beginning to correct. Remember, most corrections or collapses do not happen in 3 or 4 sessions. They often happen over 3 or 4 months or longer, with gyrations up and down in the process, with people holding on to whatever glimmer of hope they can convince themselves of in the process. This time will be no different, because human nature rarely changes, except for those rare few who have visited the abyss during the past 7 years, lived to tell about it, and will return during this collapse to help others find their way out in one way, shape, or form. The headlines are a mess this week, designed to keep most people confused and off balance. Here's a few of them. U.S. adds 173,000 jobs, jobless rate at a 7-year low. 4 reasons we know we're not ready for the Fed to raise interest rates. And on the flip side, Fed's lacquer raise rates regardless of August job report. And Bill Gross, his world is facing a new normal in which everything, interest rates and investment returns, will remain lower for longer. Headlines like these make it so people are unable to identify the true cause and effect of the current and soon to come economic tidal wave. But one article was very clear, discussing new sources of liquidity for U.S. treasuries and hedge funds. In a Wall Street Journal article, it was discussed that the top investment officers of the California State Teachers Retirement System are considering moving as much as $20 billion, or 12% of the fund's portfolio, into treasuries and hedge funds and other complex investments that they hope will perform well if markets tumble. Perhaps that 12% number, if acted upon, will become a mandatory bail-in number if everyone will be required to voluntarily contribute to treasury investments to do their part as a means of forced diversification. I've commented in years past that this time would eventually approach, and when it does, there would be so many variables on the table regarding the supposed cause or causes of the hardships people are facing, that most will gladly accept whatever the flavor or reason of the day is at that point in time without a lot of analysis. That time is now. Sharpen your critical thinking skills, because you need them now more than ever. Chris, I'd like to urge all of our listeners to sign up for my email list at conquerchange.com. Several years ago, I hosted several teleseminars on gold and the economy, and soon we'll begin hosting a series of free Conquer Change webinars. If any of our listeners are ever involved in bringing in keynote speakers for their companies or professional organizations, please visit my companion website at robertian.com, where you'll see information on my speech, Identify, Master, and Conquer Change, and just for fun, my hypnosis show. And until next time, this is Robert Ian, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at Conquer Change. Thanks, Chris.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.